If you support health care reform and want to see it ruled constitutional, you may thank a farmer named Roscoe Filburn. Though if he were alive today, he may not thank you back, because Farmer Filburn ate his wheat and sold his wheat rather than leave his field empty, as the government wanted, and proved, perhaps, that health care reform is constitutional. If you are not a fan of health care reform, as politically strange and foreign as it might sound, your best bet is Grindwald versus Connecticut or Roe v. Wade. It's the end of the Republic. Our freedoms have been tarnished, and we will soon feel the lash of the dictator. It's also a glorious new day, and a new American program has been created, the likes of which have not been seen since Social Security, Medicare, or NASA. It's the best of times, it's the worst of times. A tale of two cities? No, two countries, really. Two different views, both very strong. But I ask, what is this quintessence of irrational exuberance, to quote the poet, jazz saxophonist, and sometimes banker Alan Greenspan? It is hardly the beginning of socialism. The Democratic Party has passed the most comprehensive Republican health care reform proposal that party put forward, the only one attempted in a Republican-controlled state, one that mandates Americans buy a product from a company or pay a fine. One that mandates underwriting, now the essence of the insurance business, be controlled by the government. That's socialistic, except that portion of what has just been passed, that clearly socialistic portion, is the one that's most popular, one that probably, if statements were to be believed, would have gotten 70 to 80 votes in the Senate, including many Republicans, if it were voted on alone. The ban on denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions. On the other hand, as I await Blue Eagle parades in cities across America, jubilant bands marching through small towns, a new day has dawned, and our wise president has led America into a new era. It is, if I might use that harsh vice presidential language, a big blanking deal. We can put a man on the moon and safely return them to... No, it is a political accomplishment. Biden, although coarse, is not wrong. But in terms of changing American life, it is maybe on the level of COBRA, family medical leave, food stamps. Certainly it does not compare in pure physiology to the TARP and the stimulus bill, to the government taking over car companies, what was done earlier last year. Huge actions by your federal government. I know I'm a killjoy for both sides listening to this. And the reason is, I don't think both sides really hate this bill, though they found reasons to. And I don't think either side really likes this bill, though they found reasons to. We engage in futurist politics. If this, what next? That's what we think. So it's not so much about the program, but what it might lead to. Will this program lead to a public option if the scheme does not succeed, this triad of policies, individual mandates, subsidies, and a ban on pre-existing condition denial? If not enough healthy people get insurance, if the government can't effectively force down premiums, it might lead to something greater, a government-run insurance program to accommodate these people who need insurance where it's too expensive in the private sector. Will it lead to the severe taxation of Americans, fining, imprisoning, and more programs like this? Will we be compelled to buy other products? Will we be compelled not just to get a coupon to buy a car, but will we be forced to buy a car the next time the economy turns down? It is the future that troubles us most, and future politics. We don't just look at policies objectively. We have teams. In the passage of the bill, President Obama's legacy certainly changed. It's very difficult to deny that. Like it or not, it will be clear that this president has a legacy, even if he only gets one term. he has something next to his name in the history book. Well, he already does on account of who he is. But now he has something else, like it or hate it. Americans like driving the car. They like a president who does something, even more than they like the direction one way or the other. And they rate presidents accordingly. Polls and issues don't always match up with supports for politicians. Every one of the Democrats' issues in the 1980s had strong support in the polls. But Ronald Reagan did too, opposing those policies. For Democrats, right before the health reform bill passed the House and President Obama signed it, the idea was pass something. In 94, nothing was passed. Democrats languished. Pass something, build up the Democratic Party, build up the president. I think it's pretty clear, at least looking at the reaction in the past few days, and I know it's early, that that's happened, that that's proved right. Politically, it was much better to do something than nothing. Does the Congress act as its own factory of achievement? If you own the presidency, the White House, right, and the Congress as a party, you can create your own victories because people, in a sense, judge how well the president does with Congress. As strange as that may seem, as unfair as it might be seen if you're in the other party, I think that's exactly how it works. Therefore, that also leads me to conclude that even a much less complex policy, even a simple increase in Medicaid funding combined with some COBRA extension combined with a patient's bill of rights, let's say, could have been seen as just as much a victory in the media as this one. For those supporting Republicans, the future politics are there even sooner. There's in a midterm right now, and all history indicates that the opposing party gains seats in a first-term midterm. Spending and taxes have been brought to the forefront with this new bill, and the individual mandate promises a juicy issue for libertarians. The government's now forcing you to buy insurance, and clearly the Republican Party has staked out a position against it. The Congress and the president have now acted. So it might be time for the third branch of American politics to get involved when the other two agree. Maybe this bill that was just passed isn't even constitutional. There are several items in the Constitution that might be brought up against it. The 4th, the 8th, the 9th, the 10th, the Necessary and Proper Clause, the 14th. Will Justice Scalia, who spent a career supporting the will of elected legislatures, throw out the will of this one? I'll do my best to look at these questions. But first I want to talk about three dissents from three different Supreme Court cases and three different justices who are better known in history so far for their dissents than for their opinions. All of these dissents have risen to better consideration of their dissenting words. In Plessy v. Ferguson, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that race could separate public accommodations so long as the accommodations provided for both races were equal. The separate but equal phrase. Accommodations were rarely equal. John Marshall Harlan dissented in that case. This is wrong, he said. This decision will lead to strife. Law should be colorblind. The strangest thing about his dissent is that Harlan was a former slave owner and, in fact, had not supported Lincoln, nor did he support the 13th Amendment ending slavery. Yet in 1896, 30 years after the Civil War was over, Harlan had changed his views and was the lone dissenter, probably the man. A second dissent in history that's fairly well known was when Robert Jackson, appointed by Roosevelt, would offer an opinion against his administration's decision to intern Japanese citizens. The Constitution, he says, knows no inherited guilt. No one is guilty just as a matter of who they are. He was outvoted, but we remember his dissent in Korematsu versus the United States. And a third dissent in Morrison versus Olson, more recent one, probably more controversial one with the audience I'm speaking to. Antonin Scalia dissented on a case involving the independent prosecutor law. The court held that the independent prosecutor was constitutional. Scalia said it wasn't so. Why? Because it would hurt the executive branch. It would probably ruin a presidency, cause political problems for the president to have a prosecutor whose only job was to investigate him in a never-ending fashion. It would get out of control. It would not allow the president to work with his staff, who by the Constitution he was in charge of, in a unitary fashion. That's the part of the decision that's controversial because it's been used for other things. The president, Scalia argued, would not be able to protect his staff and would be kept at arm's length. No way to work. His dissent was written during the Reagan administration. And at that time, it looked like Scalia was merely defending the president who had appointed him. Perhaps he was, but we know this. By the time of the Clinton administration, it was clear that a special prosecutor was a problem. And Bill Clinton spent most of his presidency under fire from special prosecutors. Without a special prosecutor law, it is likely Bill Clinton never would have been impeached unless something else came up. The scope of the investigation of the special prosecutor was exactly the kind of nightmare scenario for the executive branch that Scalia had predicted. And evidence that everyone agreed the independent prosecutor law was wrong was found in 1999, when a Republican Senate and House ended the independent prosecutor law, did not renew it. I bring up these dissents because, as I said, the justices have been best known for these dissents. And all three of these justices, Justice Harlan, Justice Jackson, and Justice Scalia, have some role in the question everyone's asking. Is the health care reform that was just passed constitutional? Jackson and Harlan have no living role, only Scalia does. And I'll talk about that. But first, a very interesting question. Mikhail Silverwood asks, things are going to get interesting, I predict. This first 15 months of the Obama administration, we've seen the Democrats and Obama appease Wall Street, back down to Republican demands, and ignore hard left liberal calls for the public option, and wallow in the pits of GOP filibuster parliamentarianism. But once this reform bill is passed, exactly what will happen? Will Obama suddenly feel confident about Congress? Will the American people re-spark their yes we can spirit? Will the Tea Party attempt something dangerous or radical? Will the polls change? Will conservative anti-reform arguments win out? And will the American people despise Obama totally? What will happen? What will change? I think it's going to get interesting, so writes Mikhail Silverwood. And thank you for that question. I think on the surface, you are right to expect excitement. Something big has gone on. I won't repeat the Joe Biden quote. It's obviously a big deal for both sides. But I think you'll also get something surprising, perhaps, something that no one's really thinking of right now, and that's parity. Both sides now, after the passage of that bill, have motivated bases. There's a large group of independents who probably don't know how they feel about this bill. But in a midterm election, they're not as likely to show up. Obviously, some of them will. Republicans have a real issue, and their troops feel the process and the policy is a problem, a big problem. They feel very strongly. You brought up the issue of, will they do something dangerous or radical? The feeling is certainly there. They feel like they've been cheated. However, on the other side of things, the situation has changed for Democrats. They are now not just defending a president who, at least since he's taken office, has seemed to do some of the same things that the previous president did. Now they have a policy to defend. Both troops are going to be extremely fired up here. And as I talked about earlier, maybe not for the right reasons. This is not the creation of a new giant, great program, and it's not the end of the world, but that's not the way both of the teams will see it. I think in any study of human behavior, the most likely result of two fired up groups at parity is stalemate. This is the political equivalent of World War I. Of course, midterms give the opposition party, the party who's not in the White House, a slight historical advantage. Especially after two straight wins in Congress from the Democratic Party. On the other hand, This will be very different from 94. There isn't just this kind of apathy on the part of the Democrats. There will be excitement. A movable object meets irresistible force, and we have what we have. Of course, it would be a serious blow to that accomplishment if the Supreme Court ruled this new bill unconstitutional. Will they? Well, let's talk about Roscoe Filburn, that farmer. Filburn was, as we said, a wheat farmer, and he used the agricultural subsidies to plant wheat. These were provided by the federal government, but it also came with a mandate that wheat farmers could plant no more than 11 acres. That was his quota. He doubled it, did about 23 acres. This violated the quota set by Agricultural Secretary Wickard. Filburn used his wheat, interestingly enough, mostly for his own consumption, or he fed it to his livestock. But he also did sell a small amount. Nonetheless, he got fined for the entire violation. So he took his case all the way up to the Supreme Court, arguing, is this now commerce? Can the federal government enforce this? I didn't sell all of this wheat. I ate it. Is eating commerce? Is feeding things to the cows commerce? This was the question now left before the Supreme Court of the United States. And in a unanimous decision, Justice Robert Jackson argued that yes, the consumption of wheat and the feeding of wheat to livestock, aside from the selling that was done, just that consumption alone had a substantial effect on commerce as a whole. There was a quota set. Other farmers were following it. Who is Roscoe Filburn not to follow it? He's affecting commerce by taking this wheat out of the market, by eating wheat that he would otherwise have to buy. So your actions, negative and positive, can affect commerce, and the federal government can regulate it. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 says Congress can regulate interstate commerce. Filburn died in 1987, but his case has been precedent for decades. In the heart of Atlanta Motel decision, the government was granted the right by the Supreme Court to force any business to do business with people even if they didn't want to. Obviously, this decision involved race. You don't have a right to say who goes to your hotel and who doesn't, and the federal government can enforce it. There hasn't been much limit on the power that extends from Filburn. Only when the government tried to apply commerce to gun-free school zones, that was stopped, and when they tried to apply regulations to a state workforce, trying to regulate the workforce of a state capital, that was seen as a pretty clear violation of states' rights. Another case. In 1902, Cambridge, Massachusetts had a smallpox epidemic, and they mandated that everyone get vaccinated. For it to be effective, all men had to be vaccinated. A man named Jacobson had a bad experience as a child and didn't want to take the vaccination. He said that his bodily privacy was his ultimate freedom, and he took it all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did not agree with him. In a 7-2 decision, Justice Harlan, the man of Plessy v. Ferguson fame, ruled that the community has a right to protect itself. While Mr. Jacobson had a bad experience as a child, he is now an adult. Even more to the point, they said that Jacobson's personal opinion in this matter, how he felt about vaccines, was not relevant to what the government was doing. His individual feelings about taking a vaccine or not taking a vaccine was not relevant when compared to the community's need. It's an old case. Really is. Came down in 1905, and it's a case that's been used in a now infamous decision, Buck v. Bell, involving eugenics, in which the court allowed a forced sterilization, has not been overturned, and it is the basis of public health law. Fluoridated water, motorcycle helmets, seatbelt laws, smoking. That will be key, because I presume the federal government will argue that the compelling interest of the government is in providing better public health, though in this case, it's economic rather than a direct health initiative. But they will argue, we need people to have insurance because if a few don't, they're not getting preventative medicine, and it's leading to higher health costs for everyone and a less healthy nation. So what does this all mean so far? I think it means eat your wheat, Feed your wheat to your hogs, even if the government tells you not to. Don't get vaccinated if you don't want to. Don't wear a helmet. This means you, Ben Roethlisberger. And now, go without health insurance if you must. You rebel. But don't expect relief from the Supreme Court of the United States in your personal rebellion. Should we doubt that there will be holdouts and rebels to this new individual mandate? Oh, I bet. I can imagine people with tattoos that will say, I didn't get health insurance, neither should you. But the majority of people, enough people, will probably comply. Virginia and Texas and 11 other states at the time of this recording plan to sue. They will cite the 10th, which provides the federal government powers only that are declared by the Constitution. The rest goes to the states. Yet the 10th isn't what it used to be when the four horsemen of the Supreme Court were opposing Roosevelt's New Deal programs. The feds did force Filburn. They've prosecuted growers of medical marijuana in states that allow it because the federal government does not, even where the marijuana is grown only for the use of the person and not being sold. Current administration doesn't plan to do such federal prosecuting. But as a matter of the court, they've ruled that way. Since the New Deal, they've allowed the feds to enforce a minimum wage, child labor, drinking ages. They'd have allowed the state of New York to maintain a computer with what prescriptions you have to see if you're abusing prescription drugs and using more than you should be. Is it a nanny state? It might be, especially when you read the powers that the feds have. In a podcast, read them on a list, you hear them all at once, one after another, bam, bam, bam. But then, life is very complex now. State lines aren't what they used to be. And in the 1860s to the 1960s, there was a group of states that obviously abused those 10th Amendment rights to abuse individuals. This has whittled the power of that 10th Amendment in jurisprudence. But not only that, the Constitution has the seeds of destruction of the 10th within it. The Necessary and Proper Clause puts it in constant conflict with the 10th. The federal government can do only what's in the Constitution, but the Constitution language is slightly vague. On the 10th argument, despite many attorney generals, and the government is in so many areas of interstate life and in almost every complex transaction, it would be hard to say that health insurance is not one of these, especially when Americans bear the cost of healthcare transactions. They're not simply individual transactions, and they're not limited to state lines. Medicare, Medicaid funding for hospitals and clinics. The 10th is no place to go. The Virginia Attorney General, in addition to saying a plain text reading of the 10th would find this law unconstitutional, he says a plain text reading of the 9th reveals that it is unconstitutional. That's shocking in a sense, because anyone who can figure out a plain text reading of the 9th has really got to be a legal scholar. I mean, it essentially says that people have more rights than what is in the Constitution. There's nothing plain text at all about the 9th. Still, the Virginia Attorney General is onto something. If you are against an individual mandate, you probably want to go with the privacy argument. Assert the 4th, search and seizure. The 5th, the ability not to incriminate yourself. The 8th, no quartering of soldiers in your house. And the 9th, an acknowledgement that there's more rights than just what's spelled out in the Constitution. A shadow of privacy that lives in these amendments. Asserting a right to privacy would put you right in the middle of Griswold versus Connecticut, the case that involved use of contraception, and Roe v. Wade, the abortion decision. These would be the key cases that establishes an individual has a right to refuse an action that the state wants to do and that elected legislature wants it to do. And these cases spell out what might be a compelling interest that would override that right. Does this new healthcare law violate your privacy? Well, it does mandate to you to do a couple of things. You must engage in a transaction with a private company. It doesn't tell you which one you have to do. You have to purchase, but you must get health insurance either through your employer or on your own. There's a couple of people this might impact and limit their choices. Let's say you lose a job, But you don't want to immediately go on Cobra. You'd rather use the little money you're going to have for something else and sort of roll the dice and take your chances. You won't be able to do that under this plan, or you'll be penalized. Let's say you want to have an insurance plan that doesn't pay for prevention. You cannot. Insurance plans must pay for prevention, as that's now seen as a good thing economically and socially. Can't do that in this plan. Let's say you just feel healthy, right? You feel healthy and you don't want to take the insurance from your employer. You don't want to pay the premiums. You have to do it under this plan or you'll be penalized. Let's say you are in excellent health and you look around, you see people smoking, you see people drinking, you see people, not taking care of themselves, eating whatever they want, all kinds of unhealthy things, and you don't feel that you, in your plan, need to subsidize them. And you want to go out and find a company that does insurance just for healthy people. That will never be permitted under this law. Let's say you want to work out different kind of deals with your insurance. Like, listen, give me a payout limit, right? You can only pay me over the course of my life $500,000. I'm just throwing a number out. That's not possible under this plan. That's not a type of contract that's allowed. Let's say you want to argue, I don't have any kids, right? Why should I pay for other people to keep their kids in an insurance program beyond the age where perhaps one could argue they should have a job up till 26, right? Get out of college, say 20, 21. They're not going to have a job for 5 years. I have to pay for that. And directly, the government is going to put one more imposition on you. If you don't do any of these things, if for any of these reasons you don't get the insurance, they are going to fine you $750 annually. That's about $65 a month. And while that is far less than an insurance program would be, we have to explore the possibility that that fee could change over the years and get increased when the government needs more money. It'll be a lot easier to raise that fee than it was to pass this healthcare bill, right? It'll be a pretty simple vote. So I've just named many, many objections and many situations where this healthcare reform bill violates, if not privacy rights, individual rights. Things you want to do, but you can't do because the federal government's now forcing you. But these, to me, are fairly well mitigated by the reason for the bill. This bill that's just been passed will have the same essence as smoking laws, seatbelt laws, motorcycle helmet laws. By not wearing a helmet, you're expressing an individual right. Maybe a First Amendment right. By not wearing a seatbelt, you're proving how macho you are, right? But the government has made a decision that actuarially, people with no seatbelts get in more fatalities, and the government has a right to try to reduce those. Same thing with smoking. Smoking's been seen as something that causes cancer, causes emphysema, increases healthcare costs, and can also affect the health of others through secondhand smoke. So the government has asserted a right to reduce that activity. I imagine that the federal government in this case would argue a very similar thing. May think they're expressing an individual right, but they're damaging others because of the potential that they go into the emergency room and then become a cost, perhaps, to the public. And that by not joining the insurance pool, insurance premiums are larger. However, this is not the important question to ask if some Supreme Court of the United States down the road will find this legislation unconstitutional. It's only a matter of, will this Supreme Court, with a fairly comfortable cluster of Samuel Alito, Antonin Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, Clarence Thomas, and Justice Kennedy, will rule on it and then find it unconstitutional? First, on the question of will they hear it? They may not. Many aspects of the bill are normal in nature, and regulating insurance is a fairly normal activity for the federal government. They regulate many other businesses unchallenged by the Supreme Court. The 10th Amendment's and Commerce Clause aspects of this case, in my opinion, will not be so interesting to this court. The individual mandate is the one novel aspect of this law that I think, if it does come up, will be the reason it comes up. So that's on the question of will they hear it. They might not, they might. Secondly, on the question of will they find it unconstitutional, I think it's best to go right to the proverbial horse's mouth and say, what will Scalia do? Although this cluster of five justices certainly have their opinion, Scalia is seen as the intellectual heavyweight. I think finding this bill unconstitutional would require either a retreat to the pre-New Deal SCOTUS views of the so-called four horsemen, the four justices who opposed the Roosevelt administration's plan to regulate industries that were, in many cases, just located in a state's boundaries. In his comments in the dissent in Casey, Antonin Scalia calls those decisions erroneous, which gives some indication of how he feels about the historical actions of those four justices. It doesn't mean he might not be interested in scaling back things a bit now. Or Ninth Amendment appeal to privacy. I simply don't want to buy insurance, right? That's my privacy. Just like Jacobson didn't want to get vaccinated. Filburn wanted to eat his wheat. That's tough for two reasons. As a little enamored I am of this whole plan, as much as I think the party of Jefferson and Jackson has hurt itself a little with this insurance mandate, with clinging to this Romney plan, John Chafee plan of 94, with his individual mandate, I also am realistic enough to see that it's a fairly weak mandate. If you are poor, you're out of that mandate, and the government's going to help you buy. If you really don't want the mandate, you pay $750. That's still a lot of money, and I know it's in a recession, but it is far less than a healthcare plan. So I think you lose the sort of hardship argument that one needs to appear on the steps of the Supreme Court. You lose the burden argument. It's at that point, when you have this $750 opt-out, not much more than a tax. And even Scalia would have a hard time arguing that a tax on the part of the federal government is not an exceptional action. Ruling it unconstitutional would also put Scalia at odds with his philosophy of the supremacy of legislatures, elected officials, something he cites in almost every one of his dissents. Throwing out the vote of a Congress with a signature of the executive and perhaps imposing some test of what a mandate could and couldn't be in order to be constitutional would really put Scalia at the reverse of where he was in Casey, making laws a judge instead of allowing elected legislatures to do so. Even where Clarence Thomas, his fellow justice who rules very often along with Scalia, even where Clarence Thomas asserted in a case that there was a right to parenting clearly in the Constitution, though not spelled out, Scalia, though he's a father of nine children, and obviously expressed his support for parenting, could not find anything in the Constitution to support that view and dissented. There's a slight chance, of course, I've picked the wrong guy, that Scalia might dissent, but someone like Breyer might join with those other four justices, Kennedy, Alito, Thomas, and Roberts, and have a different set of personnel in a 5-4 decision. Why might Breyer do it? Well, he might object to the individual mandate on privacy grounds, and a way to reaffirm the absolute right to privacy in a case that's so clearly against his own normal ideology and way of ruling on cases, to prove the point the privacy right is supreme. That's a long shot, but it's possible. Okay, so what's the 800-pound gorilla in the room? There's, of course, the possibility that the court will do whatever it wants. Scalia will say, damn what I've ruled before. And you can say everything you want about and compare my old cases to this one. For perhaps ideological reasons, use the 10th or the 9th to throw this mandate out. If it does so, it will have to rely heavily on the fact that the law forces the individual to buy something from a company, which is a novel concept. I still do not believe, even after having been ruled constitutional, this bill is over, though it may put the Congress in a difficult position of having to go with a less popular tax to pay for these subsidies for 30 million people. But I can't imagine any court decision robbing 30 million people of subsidies and Medicaid benefits. The ammunition for the argument that someone like a Scalia is just going to rule where, however they want and not listen to even their own precedents is often found in Bush v. Gore, the case that, in effect, led to the Bush presidency. But that case, I think, is very different. And I don't subscribe entirely to the view that Justice Scalia is a person that operates, you know, secretly to help the Republican Party. Bush v. Gore was a different case for a couple of reasons. One, it clearly says in Bush v. Gore that it cannot be used as precedent for any other case. But even though something says that, we all know it will be cited in case law. The other is the national emergency that Bush v. Gore prevented. And if the Supreme Court did not rule, perhaps the argument goes, whether you agree with it or not, they would have sacrificed the image of the court and the prestige of the court if they sort of punted the ball to a state court. It is often said that in ruling in Bush v. Gore, Scalia violated his long-held principle of states' rights. And that is partially true. Again, he cites the emergency of the situation. And we also must remember that that did involve a state court rather than a state legislature. If that had gone to the Florida state legislature, they were ready to vote the electoral votes for George Bush in Florida in the legislature. It was the state Supreme Court that had ruled there should be another recount. In any case, I don't see Bush v. Gore as relevant as some others might in this case, and I don't see Scalia as this kind of towering bully who will just rule anyway to make sure his side wins. I think he'll have real problems with his philosophy on other cases if he were to rule this unconstitutional. But time will tell. I want to thank you for listening. A lot of talk on the Facebook site. Website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. The archive is available there. It is still $9.99. All indications are the recession is close to over. I will be raising the price on that probably around the end of April, so get it now. It's a tremendous value. There's hours and hours of podcasts. A lot of times I'll get questions on the Facebook site. There was, for instance, a question about guns, a question about the filibuster. I have podcasts in the archive on these. You know, I often find myself going back to my own podcast. I mean, I don't always remember what I said. Podcast started in 2006, and so I think it's a great value. It's only $9.99 now, so, you know, in a sense, get it while it's hot. I want to thank you for listening.